faith during a pandemic.
We don't have synagogue service. We don't have Torah readings. We don't have bar mitzvahs, weddings. Everything is different.
I'm Marco Werman. Today, a special edition of The World, worshiping when you can't get together. Rituals have changed.
It's lonely. It's unsettling. There's no crescendo to the death. It's like everyone's ignoring it.
And keeping the faith when the world looks grim.
The Buddha taught that beings encounter unpleasantness and suffering in life. It's unavoidable. So again, why are we surprised?
How does Islam explain cancer? How does Islam explain global famine? How does Islam explain the Black Plague?
And what surfing has to do with facing a pandemic. Those stories and more today on The World. We've witnessed some extraordinary things in the past couple of months.
Did you ever think it would get this bad?
No, not in a million years.
This pandemic is historic. Today, the global death toll from COVID-19 surpassed 100,000 lives. It stirs up all kinds of emotions: fear, sorrow, panic, shock. We're all seeing human suffering, a lot of it seemingly random in a way that's hard to comprehend. So, aside from science, how to understand it? Today, April 10th, is Good Friday. It's the middle of Passover week and 2 weeks before Ramadan. Here's how one of you described this moment.
This is Annalise Seiderveld from Oakland, California. On a week where we remember what makes Good Friday good and Easter Sunday jubilant, I think I'm most relating with that day in between. Some days, I'm feeling rooted in hope, and other days, a wave of grief rolls over me when I hear of the number of people who have died or are sick, when I see the anxiety and fear of friends and strangers on social media. My faith has seen me through other hard periods of my life, and it's what sustains me now.
We'll be hearing from more of you on the show today. Muslims, Christians, and Jews are not the only ones turning to faith right now to process the new reality. Buddhists, Hindus, animists, as well as the 1+ billion people in the world who live secular lives and maybe do not believe in a god or gods, but find solace in something else, nature or music, even knitting. So this is what we're doing today on The World, asking how people around the globe are turning to faith in all its forms in the midst of this massive health crisis. And we begin with one of the most wrenching parts of this pandemic, how to mourn in the time of COVID-19. The World's Orla Barry has been looking into that.
Daniel Cantor's dad, David, came to visit him in Dallas, Texas over Christmas. That's when an infection on David's leg started to bother him.
They couldn't figure out why his white blood cells weren't fighting this infection off, and they finally realized that he had leukemia.
Cantor says his dad passed away on March 18th, but he considers himself lucky because he was able to be at his father's bedside when he died. His siblings, though, were not allowed to travel because of the coronavirus. In the state of Texas, funerals are now limited to 10 people or less. So I asked Daniel about how the family marked his father's death.
A few days ago, we picked up his ashes from the crematorium. My mom is stuck here because she's not wanting to travel. The plan is that she'll take the ashes with her, and we'll try to gather family and friends around their home in the summer, hopefully, and spread my dad under the apple tree where my grandparents are spread.
A ban on gatherings is having a profound impact on families who've lost a loved one. And Daniel says it makes it all seem pretty unreal.
It feels kind of like it didn't even happen, with no kind of response except sort of in our home storytelling. There's no crescendo to the death. It's like everyone's ignoring it.
Sharing stories can be an important part of the grieving process. In rural Ireland, it's the main feature of the traditional wake. The body of the deceased is laid out in the family's home for a day or more, and friends and neighbours come together to share memories, sing songs, and have a drink or two. When Betty Ryan died in County Kerry last month, her family knew a wake was out of the question, but locals came up with an idea. Sean McIntyre is Ryan's next door neighbour.
It was decided to line the route, which is just over a mile long, from the church down to the local graveyard. Everyone came out, lined the roads, kept the 2 metre social distance apart. It was quite a poignant event.
Macintihig says locals are figuring out ways to take ownership of the grieving process, and they have their own traditions.
The community takes turns on the shovels. They actually fill the grave while the family are still in the graveyard. And it helps with the grieving process, you know, because gradually as the grave is being filled, you can hear the hum of conversation. You can hear laughter then as people reminisce and tell stories about the person who has just been buried.
But this custom is now no longer allowed. Halting or altering funeral rituals is happening all over and across most religious traditions right now. Stephen Lewis's mother, Ruth, died in London on March 19th. Lewis, who's Jewish, said the local rabbi warned them that restrictions would have to be in place.
He said that what they were going to do was for the first time ever, they were going to do it all outside. Under normal circumstances, there probably would have been about 400 or 500 people there. I think about 30 people, 35 people turned up.
Lewis's nephew in Australia suggested they show the funeral on Facebook Live so relatives all over could take part too.
For me, it was like there's a Jewish word for like a mitzvah, which is like a blessing. So it was a blessing that people could actually watch it. And yeah, it made me feel good. I have to be honest. It did make me feel good.
The Jewish tradition of sitting Shiva for up to 7 days when people come by a family's home to pay respects has also largely been stopped. All the changes are upsetting for some families.
Literally, our phones are going all the time. People are crying on the phone. They're in deep, deep shock.
This is Hasina Zaman, founder of Compassionate Funerals in East London. It does services for people of all faiths, including the large local Muslim community. In the Islamic tradition, there's a ritual to wash the body of the deceased before burial. But some Muslim leaders now recommend an abbreviated version of that ritual. And Zaman says that's been tough to take for some families.
They're upset, really devastated, because they can't do that last performance, you know. That's their last duty they have to give to their loved one.
Zaman wears a mask and protective clothing as much as possible when she works. But she says her own family were initially furious when she decided to continue at her job.
They were really, really angry with me and saying that, you know, you can potentially kill us. I said, look, I'm doing my best to take all the precautions. But what I want you guys to know is that by me doing my job, I'm actually helping a lot more people than just saying that I'm going into isolation.
Zaman says they've since come around and now couldn't be more supportive. Back in Texas, Daniel Cantor is supporting his mother and also the wider community because he's a minister at First Unitarian Church in Dallas. He says he hopes his own experience with grief will teach him how to help others get through this challenging time. Cantor tells me it's not just words from scripture that bring him comfort in this time of trial.
C.S. Lewis's sort of reminder that grief can feel like fear, can be ungrounding, it can be destabilizing in your life. And, you know, I think what he's saying to us is, you know, walk a little more softly on your path, be a little more gentle with each other, be a little more honest with your feelings and with others. And that, those are certainly things that I'm trying to practice right now.
For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
The hardest hit people in this pandemic are the ones losing their lives, obviously, and their loved ones. For everyone, though, it's a kind of extraordinary event that can test your faith. Wajahat Ali is a writer and lawyer whose faith was already being severely tested over the past year. He and his wife found out their 2-year-old daughter had liver cancer. Wajahat told me about the moment he learned about that diagnosis while he was traveling last spring.
I remember my first instinct was just to make a fist and punch the pillow and yell no. And then afterwards, I did what I call the universal barter prayer that all parents do. My life for my kid's life. Let's do a trade. And you expect a voice to come back and say, oh, that's a fair trade. 39-year-old, you know, man with a dad bod with a receding hairline for a beautiful girl. No problem. But there's no answer. And so I sat there alone in my hotel room and I just remembered, you know, there's a saying in Islam, first tie your camel and then leave your trust to God. And that's the answer to both what's happening in coronavirus, how we're going to endure Ramadan, and what happened when I found out about Nuseiba. And that basically means you do everything you can in your human power, and then you leave it to God. And so that's the kind of mindset that I had. We will do everything we can in our powers to save this little girl, but I will leave it to God.
Well, things turned out really well. Nuseiba, your daughter, was able to leave the hospital with her new liver, donated, right, by someone you didn't even know. In your mind, was that God at work or just basic human kindness?
I think you have to take the good with the bad. You have to take all of it, right? Was it God at work? Sure. It was also human kindness at work. It was decency at work. It was science. It was medicine. There were means created that allowed my daughter to live. Everyone is experiencing challenges in life, some more than others. And I believe you have to take the good with the bad. That's the perspective that I like to take. And you don't have to be religious. You don't have to believe in God. But I just tell everyone that if both of us had put our foot in what I call the emotional mental quicksand, we'd be destroyed. And that quicksand says the following. Why me? Why us? We were good. We did everything right. Why my girl? Damn you, God. F you to the universe. And then you go to a very dark place, a paralyzing place. And thankfully, we avoided that. And I leaned it very hard and very deep to my faith. And it helped me.
So in January, Nuceiba was declared cancer-free. And then there was this almost immediate pivot to the coronavirus beginning its deadly path across the world. You believe faith helped you personally through difficult times with your daughter. How does Islam explain why the whole world is suffering through a pandemic?
Yeah, early January, Nuceiba was declared cancer-free, and that's when my wife and I said, hey, 2020 is going to be normal. And lo and behold, here we are now. You know, it's a good question. Like, how does Islam explain cancer? How does Islam explain global famine? How does Islam explain the Black Plague? How does Islam explain the Holocaust? I think human beings throughout the history of time have suffered both as a result of crises and catastrophes, plagues, and as a result of our own cruelty. And throughout, I think Islam in the Quran and in the hadith of the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad has says that people will be tested and challenged. Each generation has its own challenges. And it's how you face that challenge and endure that challenge, how you have both gratitude and patience during those struggles, how even in the most immensely trying times, you can still try to be selfless and decent and kind. That is not just a test, but an opportunity. And those who can behave in such a manner, those are the people who are the most favored by God. And so this is a challenge for our generation, Marco. I mean, 100 years ago, they had influenza. The greatest generation had World War II, World War I. This is a unique challenge for our generation, something that we have never seen. And how will we emerge from it? That's the question I have. Can we actually use this to become better? My answer to that is yes. And I think each person has a chance to be our hero here. In small ways, we can be decent. And maybe that's how you can be godly as well.
Writer Wajahat Ali, it is always good to speak with you. Thanks for being with us and sharing your thoughts today.
Thank you, Marco.
For many of us, faith takes the shape of respect for the natural world. That was a massive chunk of an iceberg calving off into the Greenland Sea, and that gasp was from Italian pianist Ludovico Einaudi. Einaudi was a little taken aback because he was very close to that iceberg as he performed this work, Elegy for the Arctic. He's literally on a small platform in that sea, floating by the icebergs. So is his grand piano. This piece was commissioned by Greenpeace a couple of years ago. It's a spectacular scene. You can see it at our website, theworld.org, and you're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The Zoom Seder. At this point, it's an experience well known to Jews around the world.
This is Tori. I live in Amsterdam. I'm starting to think that the Seder It's been an important and fundamental part of the identity of my family. We've been getting up every morning, leaving messages for each other across time zones from Hawaii to Amsterdam, making our plans, trying to arrange how this will work. So we'll have a breakfast Seder in Hawaii and a late evening Seder in Amsterdam. I just hope that Zoom can hold us all and make us feel a little bit closer in these times of distance.
A month ago, Passover online would have been unthinkable. For Orthodox Jewish communities, it's still controversial. Reporter Rebecca Rossman has our story.
How can a rabbi do their job in the time of the coronavirus? Meish Schwartz, a rabbi based in Brookline, Massachusetts, says it's complicated.
We don't have synagogue service. We don't have Torah readings. We don't have bar mitzvahs, bas mitzvahs, weddings. Everything is different.
A lot of rabbis have been conducting services using video conferencing platforms like Zoom. But Schwartz is an Orthodox rabbi who follows traditional Jewish law, which prohibits the use of electricity during the Sabbath and other holidays.
So therefore, Zoom on Sabbath or holidays is, you know, not acceptable.
This issue has created a lot of catch-22s. For example, Jewish law requires a quorum of at least 10 people to create what's called a minyan, or prayer group. Some people say the rules should be adjusted to allow video conferencing. Schwartz agrees, but he's also skeptical.
You know, Zoom wouldn't have helped the Jews if they were in Egypt. You know, they still wanted to get out of Egypt.
That's a reference to the Passover holiday that started earlier this week. For thousands of years, Jews have gathered at the Seder table to retell the story of their emancipation from ancient Egypt. Under normal circumstances, Schwartz would have led a Seder of around 60 people. This year, for the first time, he celebrated with just his immediate family. The same was true for Rabbi Walter Rothschild. Even though he follows a more liberal interpretation of Judaism, he's not a fan of Zoom.
A screen is so inhuman.
Rabbi Rothschild is based in Berlin and runs two Reform synagogues in Warsaw and Hamburg.
Touching somebody when they come up to the scroll and shaking their hands and leading their arm to point where to go, things like this. Yes, it's not an orgy, a Jewish service, but there is physical contact, limited, but there, and you miss it.
But other rabbis are seeing an upside to streaming religious services.
At the moment, it's been much greater attendance, much more enthusiasm.
Rabbi Joel Osaran is based in Jerusalem, but runs the congregation Beth Hillel in Rome. Even though his congregants can't join hands, they can join voices, he says. During last weekend's Shabbat services, which he hosted on Zoom, he unmuted everyone's sound so they could sing one of the most popular Shabbat prayers together, the Shema Yisrael.
Even though they couldn't even hear the words, they all knew what the words were. And they felt that they were part of a group.
Feeling like you're a part of a group has been one of the biggest challenges for all of us, Osaran says. He'll probably have everyone sing the Shema Yisrael together again this weekend and the next, until they can join hand in hand once again. For the world, I'm Rebecca Rossman.
In normal times, Pope Francis waves and offers blessings from a window above St. Peter's Square in Rome. Since Italy went into lockdown, the Pope has been online instead.
Vorrei ringraziare anche tutti I sacerdoti, la creatività dei sacerdoti.
In mid-March, Francis thanked Catholic priests across Italy for how they're carrying out their duties. The clergy follows centuries-old traditions, but these days they're improvising. Reporter Francesca Berardi has our story.
One morning in March, Father Andrea Vena loaded a statue of the Madonna onto his three-wheeled car and set off through the street of his village, Bibbiano, on the coast near Venice. With a microphone in hand, he recited prayers, sprinkled holy water, and handed out pictures of saints to the few people he saw on the street. About 80% of the population in Italy identifies as Catholic. Figuring out how to offer them pastoral care while the country is in quarantine has been a challenge. One priest with a pilot's license used a small airplane to fly over an area hit hard by COVID-19 and send blessings to the people. But by far the most popular way to reach worshippers is not using a megaphone or an airplane, but social media. Chiara Canonici has been following Sunday Mass on the Facebook page of her parish since Italy went into lockdown.
Per Cristo nostro Signore.
Amen.
Il Signore sia con voi.
E con il tuo spirito.
In alto.
Chiara says that following Mass online is not the same as going to church, but it has a meaning.
Mi ricorda che la domenica è un giorno per la fede cristiana diverso dagli altri.
It reminds me that for the Christian faith, Sunday is a day that's different from the others. Living in isolation, all the days are the same, but this reminds me that Sunday must be sanctified.
Father Paolo Benanti is a professor of ethics and technology at the Pontifical Gregorian University of Rome. He says that the current crisis is fostering new forms of popular devotion. It's like a new dance, he says.
It's like if we move from an old Austrian waltzer to a tango, in which we have to have a little bit of improvisation, and is also much more cheek-to-cheek, much more intimate to people.
Some priests refuse to stream their masses. They are worried the sacred rites might be confused with popular entertainment. But they are willing to use online tools for other purposes. Father Luca Peyron is supporting doctors and nurses working in hospitals.
Vi sto sentendo con tutti gli strumenti che permettono di vedersi in faccia. Una telefonata non è sufficiente.
I'm talking to them with all the tools that allow you to see their faces. A phone call is not enough. And so, blessed be the digital. You've got to see the color of a face, to look in a person's eyes, because sometimes these are what reveal a pain that words have trouble expressing.
Father Luca believes the void that people are experiencing is an opportunity to awaken their spirituality. Another priest from Turin, Father Gianni Ghiglione, agrees. He points out that the suffering people are coping with coincides with a solemn time in the Christian calendar, the period known as Lent.
Like it or not, we're all living in a huge Lent. The fatigue, penitence, fear, loneliness, anguish.
This crisis has confronted people with some of their greatest fears and forced them to reflect on what's most meaningful in life.
It's a petty little thing that's bringing the world to its knees. Maybe we find out that we weren't such superhumans.
Father Gianni hopes that this feeling, this understanding that we are humble creatures, will survive the virus. And with this thought, while Italy is flattening its curve, it prepares for Easter, the reawakening. For The World, I'm Francesca Berardi, in Torino, Italy.
News headlines are coming up next. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. For many religious traditions, a pandemic is a test of faith. This Islamic scholar says coronavirus is an even bigger challenge.
I think this is also a test of not just faith, but also reason, of rationality, of responsibility.
And in Mexico City, the Passion Play must go on. The audience is just watching from home. Still ahead here on The World. Instead of going to Mass, Catholics everywhere are observing Holy Week from home. In Mexico City, people are watching a real-life reenactment of the Stations of the Cross on television.
¿Qué quieres?
Justicia! Justicia! La cruz para Nazareno! Justicia!
Normally, this is a big public event, but not this year, as The World's Jorge Valencia reports.
At the center of the reenactment, of course, is a man portraying Jesus Christ. He wears a blood-stained robe, a crown of thorns, and a 200-pound cross. Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they are doing. Those are the words of Jesus as he falls with the cross on his shoulder, in the Bible and in this video of last year's reenactment. Surrounding Jesus are hundreds of others in full costume. There are Romans, there are Jews, they're all actors, and in real life, they're all from Mexico City's working-class borough of Iztapalapa. Tito Dominguez is the vice president of the group that organizes the Via Crucis of Iztapalapa.
Yo le pronuncio con X simple Iztapalapa.
Dominguez has been around long enough to pronounce the name the old-school way, with an X, Iztapalapa. He's 57, and over the last four decades, he's played several characters.
Y 12 años continuos hice el papel de Judas. Iscariote.
And for 12 consecutive years, Dominguez portrayed Judas, the disciple who snitches on Jesus and turns him over to the Romans. Someone had to play the bad guy, and that person was me, Dominguez says. Although he adds that Judas rarely gets the credit he deserves because Jesus prophesies that a disciple would betray him. And without betrayal, there is no prophecy. As Dominguez explains it, the coronavirus pandemic is not the first time that Catholics in Mexico City have faced widespread disease. There was a cholera outbreak in 1833. According to Mexican researchers, it claimed the lives of more than 14,000 people in just 3 months.
Por la mañana acompañaban a una persona a sepultarla.
In the morning, the people of Iztapalapa would bury someone. Then those same people would die that night and be buried the following day, Dominguez says. So the survivors, mostly orphans, prayed for a miracle.
Y le fueron a implorar todos los que, pues, en esa época quedaron vivos.
Dominguez says that a decade later, in 1843, the survivors started the reenactment as a way to thank God for granting them the miracle of ending the cholera outbreak. And the event grew. Tens of thousands have been visiting for years as the procession goes down the streets of Iztapalapa and ends with the crucifixion of Jesus at the top of a hill. But not this year. As a response to the coronavirus pandemic and to avoid crowds from gathering, the reenactment is being held behind closed doors in the same atrium where it started 177 years ago.
Mira, yo creo que la historia es cíclica. Es una espiral.
Look, I think history is cyclical, Dominguez says. It repeats itself. So they're broadcasting the event on social media and television so worshipers can still watch.
Al joven que hace el papel de Cristo es, para mucha gente es como ver a Jesucristo, ¿no?
For a lot of people, seeing the young man who portrays Jesus is like seeing Jesus Christ himself, Dominguez says.
Mi nombre es Mauricio Luna Reyes. Tengo 19 años de edad.
Mauricio Luna Reyes is that young man. He's 19, he's studying sports and recreation management, and he grew up in a neighborhood next to the Iztapalapa Borough Hall.
Esta casa al costado es de donde está la delegación.
Luna Reyes was selected from a pool of 24 applicants. The requirements include being 18, in good health, and not having any tattoos. Being Jesus is a big deal. In January, Luna Reyes started training to carry the 200-pound cross on his shoulder for more than a mile. But he says that for him, what's more difficult is the spiritual preparation.
No solamente representas a Jesús, representas a la comunidad donde se hace esa representación. Representas la fe de esa comunidad.
You don't only represent Jesus, Luna Reyes says. You represent the entire community and the faith of the community. Especially now that most actors won't get to participate and that worshipers won't get to watch in the flesh, he says. Beside him will be the Virgin Mary, also known as Ana Laura Ortega Jurado.
Soy del barrio de San Miguel.
She is from the San Miguel neighborhood. She's 19 and she teaches English at a preschool.
No, en español porque me pongo nerviosa.
Although she prefers Spanish, she says, because she gets nervous in English. Ortega Jurado comes from a family that has long been involved in the reenactment.
De hecho, mi tío en 1996 salió de Cristo.
In fact, she says, in 1996, her uncle represented Jesus and her aunt represented the Virgin Mary. And she says that she offers a special prayer on Easter every year, but that this year it's different.
Creo que ahora no pedimos ni tanto por mí ni por mi familia, sino creo que por todo el mundo.
We won't be praying for ourselves or for our families, Ortega Jurado says. We'll be praying for the world. For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia.
Passion play or playing off passion? The late Nigerian percussionist Babatunde Olatunji here from his groundbreaking recording, Drums of Passion, which honors the Yoruba deity Chango. The coronavirus is impacting certain communities more than others, and in some parts of the world, the outbreak is even stoking sectarian tension. In India, some people are blaming Muslims for the spread of COVID-19. The world's Rupa Shenoy reports.
When the coronavirus hit, India was coming off some of the worst rioting in decades. Police were accused of standing by while mobs of Hindu men attacked Muslim neighborhoods, burning, looting, and beating Muslims in the streets.
And nothing was done by the government. No one was held to account. There were no criminal charges.
Mobasher Tazamal is a London-based researcher with Georgetown University. In addition to the anti-Muslim violence, she says there was an uptick in online Islamophobia starting in mid-March. That's when the first known coronavirus super spreader event happened in India. It was an annual conference in New Delhi held by an international Muslim missionary group called the Tablighi Jamaat. More than 1,000 people from several countries traveled to be there, and apparently some were infected. Some traveled domestically, and outbreaks followed across the country.
So what far-right media, even mainstream media, online, you know, voices have done is use this instant to kind of support their theory that this is the sinister plot devised, planned by Muslims to target the wider population.
India continues to see a surge in coronavirus cases linked to the Tablighi Jamaat event. As the cases rise, Maulana Saad, the Amir of the Tablighi Jamaat, is still at large. On Monday, the Delhi...
They are taking this into, like, criminal proceedings, accusing the imam, the leaders of the organization, of criminal intent.
Bigoted hashtags like Corona Jihad started trending online. Now, Tazamal says, many people in India believe there's a Muslim conspiracy to spread the virus. Doctors, nurses, and social workers who've tried to go into neighborhoods to help have been chased away or pelted with rocks. People suspect they're Muslims, bringing the disease.
They're being attacked, so they're afraid to go into certain areas because people believe these theories that these are the people responsible for spreading the virus.
At the same time, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, a Hindu nationalist, is appealing to Hindu beliefs in his response to the virus.
Namaskar. Corona, vaishvik mahamari ke khilaf.
He made this speech at 9 a.m. He asked people to turn off their lights and light lamps at 9 p.m. for 9 minutes. University of Massachusetts Amherst professor Banu Subramaniam says that request was full of references to ancient Hindu scriptures called the Vedas.
It's all over the web. People giving Vedic science explanations for the power of nine that Mr. Modi is unleashing against the coronavirus.
There have been a lot of suggested Vedic treatments and Hindu explanations for the coronavirus.
So, for example, drinking cow urine. Someone also claimed that the coronavirus is actually an angry punishment for non-vegetarians because the claim is that this emerged from the wet markets in China. And so the Chinese are being taught a lesson through the coronavirus. So this is protecting the poor creatures of Earth who should not be eaten by humans.
That may sound strange to Westerners. And Subramaniam says there is a feeling among many Hindus that the Western world just doesn't get their religion.
People really feel that Indian medicine, Indian cultural practices are superior to the West.
What follows over the next few weeks may put those beliefs to the test. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
This period of self-isolation, many say, is a good time to focus on mindfulness, to refocus, to ward off panic, to not think about the past or the future. Hard right now, I know, but just be in the here and now. In some religions, chanting helps to settle the mind and prepare it for meditation. These are Buddhist nuns in the Himalayas. Our next guest works with them. Karma Lekshe Somo is a Buddhist nun herself and a professor of Buddhism. She splits her time between India and the U.S. Lekshe spoke with me from Honolulu. I asked her if there was a moment in her life that prepared her for this pandemic.
It happened to me in India about 30 years ago when I got bitten by a viper, a poisonous snake, and my whole world changed in that one moment. And I faced death head on for 3 months, not knowing from day to day whether I would be alive tomorrow. And so this really taught me the value of these teachings on how to be completely in the present moment, let go of the past, let go of the future, and focus completely on this precious present moment. The Buddha taught that beings encounter unpleasantness and suffering in life. It's unavoidable. So why are we surprised?
The narrative of many religions is one turns to God or Allah or Yahweh. What does Buddha tell you to do right now as a Buddhist leader?
A lot of people are feeling restricted. They're feeling angry. They're not liking confinement. And yet, our situation, as whatever it may be, can't be compared to the sufferings of refugees in the camps who are struggling even for water and food. So loving kindness is an excellent method for cutting through our own anger and aversion. Also the teaching on compassion for the sufferings of others, not to turn away, but whatever resources we have to try to contribute to relieve the sufferings of others.
Right in the moment, though, for people who are facing death of a loved one or have just experienced that, what solace or guidance can Buddhism give them?
Well, the Buddhist teachings give us lots of practices for how to calm the mind. So it may seem a bit idealistic. On the other hand, it could be survival to cultivate a calm and quiet mind. If we're frantic, if we're panicked, we can't really be a resource for those around us. So they have a practice of mindfulness of breathing. It's a very simple practice that can be done by anyone of any religion or no religion, just simply to be aware of the gentle flow of our breath as it flows in and flows out. In other words, to just calm down, be completely in the moment, and be aware of our own breathing. Another practice would be to be flexible, to be able to flow with the circumstances, pleasant or unpleasant. This is called the practice of equanimity. You know, usually we reel from, you know, highs to lows, and we're on a roller coaster of emotions. And in this case, we bring suffering to ourselves and also disturb those around us. So if we can handle any circumstance calmly, then we'll be happier campers, and the people around us will certainly appreciate it too.
I just want to point out that your childhood was spent in Southern California, and you're a surfer, were anyway. I think surfer is kind of, it's a lifelong thing. You were top rank in your teens, though. Do you still surf, and what is the connection to Buddhism?
Well, when I was young, my whole life was surfing. I mean, I dreamed surfing. So I'm very grateful for being in touch with the ocean, having this opportunity to be in solitude. It gave me a kind of perspective. You know, when you're out in the ocean waiting for a set, you see the world from a different viewpoint. You recognize that you're basically alone in the universe, but also that you're not the most important thing in the universe. I'm really grateful for that. And you learn to be quiet in the present moment, to be prepared for any situation.
Venerable Karma Lekche Somo is a Buddhist nun and social activist. She's a professor of Buddhism and world religions at the University of San Diego. Thank you for this conversation. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
This is Ali from Portland, Oregon. I am a two-year-old sort of convert to Islam. This is going to be my first year fasting. Though what I'm truly miss, though, in these times is meeting together and performing prayer in unison with my brothers, because that gives such a form of camaraderie and unity just to be that physically close. But that's quite the opposite of what we're supposed to do now. So I am dreadfully missing that, and I miss it.
Ali is expressing what many observant people are missing right now. Scientists are scrambling to find a vaccine for the coronavirus. Policymakers are trying to flatten the curve. And religious leaders all over are trying to help people of faith understand what it all means. The World's Matthew Bell spent some time talking with several of them.
Swarnjit Arora has lived through a lot in his 79 years. He was born in part of British India, that's Pakistan today. Arora had just turned 7 when partition took place. In the spasm of religious violence that followed, relatives of his were killed. His family, along with more than 10 million others, fled their home. As a young man, Arora left South Asia to start a new life in a new country.
When I came to the United States, I still remember I had $3.84 in my pocket.
Arora went on to become a professor of economics. He says he was the first man with a turban to immigrate to the Milwaukee area. Back then, members of the Sikh community met in each other's homes to pray. Now, there are 3 Sikh temples in the area. What gets Arora through tough times like this pandemic, he says, is his faith in God.
We cannot blame for each and everything onto God. God does his best. He gives us tolerance. And it's up to us how we handle it.
Aurora says people at his temple are collecting food for the needy and reaching out to older folks stuck in their homes. In many religious traditions, calamity is often seen as a test of faith. Mustafa Akyol is an expert on Islam and modernity at the Cato Institute in Washington. With this particular calamity of coronavirus, Akyol says there's something else going on.
I think this is also a test of not just faith, but also reason, of rationality, of responsibility.
And here's the sort of thing he's talking about. This video from CNN, shot outside of a church in Ohio last week, has been making the rounds on social media.
I ask you about your decision to go to church to be inside that building.
I wouldn't be anywhere else.
Aren't you concerned you could infect other people if you get sick inside?
No.
People that don't go to this
church. No. I'm covered in Jesus' blood.
Other people?
There has been various religious groups around the world, in almost all religious traditions, who thought, this is not a big deal. God will protect us. We can still go to the church, the mosque, or the synagogue, and our faith will be our shield. And by thinking that way, they acted irresponsibly, and they put many lives in danger. So the virus is testing our faith, but also it's testing our rationality. And if we don't act rationally, this will be a defeat for the whole worldview of religion.
Mustafa Akyol says the pandemic reminds him of one story in the Islamic tradition. Someone asks the Prophet Muhammad a question. Should I tie up my camel so no one can steal it, or should I trust in God? The Prophet answers, tie up your camel and then put your trust in God. In Judaism, there's a similar idea that the faithful will be protected by the divine, but people need to live up to their side of the bargain too. And that means living a life that emulates the divine, says Lila Kajdan. She's an Orthodox rabbi in Brookline, Massachusetts.
And emulating the divine means following rules, means adhering to safety regulations, hand washing. I mean, one of the most holy aspects and expressions in Jewish life is washing one's hand before consumption of bread. In other words, before starting any meal, there's hand washing with a special blessing.
Kajdan says the Talmud, the central text in the Jewish tradition, has a lot to say about earthly catastrophes like a pandemic. But the most important thing, she says, is this.
Judaism values human life and the care and maintenance of human life above all other things. And really, this is an opportunity to catapult the Jewish community, really guided by our faith, to do good, to do right, to be in caregiving roles, to give charity, and to think about what to do when these difficult things happen.
But why do bad things like this happen? If there is an all-knowing God who's looking out for the best interests of humanity, why is he or she allowing this wave of death to sweep across the world right now?
That's a real good question. I don't have an answer, and nobody else does either.
Michael Curry is the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church. He says the New Testament doesn't help answer this question either.
There's no, you know, Jesus' words are in red letter. There's no, like, gold letters from the Father. And when he's on the cross and cries, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? There is no answer from heaven. There is no answer from heaven on the cross. But there is Easter morning.
Hinting at what he'll preach about on Sunday, Curry mentions a German-American theologian born in the late 1800s named Paul Tillich, who described faith this way.
Faith is not the absence of doubt. It's not the absence of fear. It's not the absence of anxiety. It's not having all the answers. It's not having it all together. Faith is affirming being in spite of the threat of non-being. That's his language. Faith is standing for love in spite of the power of hatred and selfishness. Faith is caring about others in spite of the powerful temptation to care less about others and to care only about yourself.
Curry says this is a trying time for religious folks from different backgrounds. During the High Holy Days, getting together in communal worship is so important, and that cannot happen right now. The bishop will be delivering his Easter sermon from his home in North Carolina. It'll be part of the Sunday morning service streamed online from the National Cathedral in Washington, which will be mostly empty. For the world, I'm Matthew Bell.
It is a tough time, to be sure. Personally, it always helps me to remember that as hard as things are, there are people who've been through worse. And will you ring the bells when you come back? I think about this song by South African singer-songwriter Vusi Malesela, When You Come Back. Vusi wrote it for Nelson Mandela while the freedom fighter was still in prison. Mandela survived 27 years in isolation with patience, hope, and, though he practiced Christianity discreetly, some prayer. We all cope in the ways we know how. Thank you for listening today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH. As always, stay strong, stay safe, be well. We'll see you back here Monday.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.